I'm Jason Walker. This is IRN USA Radio News.
Once there was a civilization, much like ours, but with a greater intelligence, greater powers, and a greater capacity for good.
Though you've been raised as a human being, you are not one of them.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome to the Light of Day, coming to you live on the Orion Talk Radio Network. We're live Saturday night, June 26, 2010. Welcome to the Light of Day show. Well, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to play a pre-recorded interview that I conducted with Nancy Leader from this morning out of North Freedom, Wisconsin. I don't necessarily subscribe to her channeled information kind of coming from extraterrestrials. But at the same token, we do need to explore all the research that's being done out there, just because I believe anything's possible, and who knows, maybe I could be wrong in the end on that. And most of the Planet X researchers, including John DiNardo and Gilbert Erickson, and us three believe that Planet X is out there by Jupiter right now. Anyway, I'm still got kids running around here, and I'm going to try to get them off the bed. So I'm going to play this pre-recorded interview, and we should possibly have it done as we go into the beginning of the second hour, and then I'm going to play my new soundbite I created today and then read some news articles. I'm going to bring this up, this soundbite with Nancy Lehner, as soon as I get the CD player initiated here. Again, you're listening to The Light of Day. We're live Saturday night, June 26th, 2010. If anybody wants to shoot me an email, it's gem3 in Tucson at q.com. That's gem3 in Tucson, like you're in the city of Tucson, at q.com. Anyway, here's the pre-recorded interview with Nancy Leader. Please enjoy.
Hello?
Hello, Nancy?
Yeah, is this Sheldon?
Yeah, this is Sheldon.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, well, welcome to The Light of Day. We're doing a pre-recorded for my radio show here, as you know, and right off the bat, I'd like you to explain to my audience what happened. You know, I've only been in this for maybe 7 months. I still have a lot to learn and catch up on here on this topic, but what happened back in 2003? How come Planet X didn't come by at that time?
Well, it came in, but it didn't pass. You know, the Zeta said the passage would occur. And they gave all kinds of specifics about where to look in the sky. In about 1997, they gave explicit Ra and Dic, that's right angle and declination, which is like the point in the sky, X and Y, right? And they said, this is where you'll see it, and as you're looking out from Earth, and it was a little bit of a twisted path, but coming toward us, and to the right of Orion, but not as far over as Taurus and Aries, and that's where it was going to arrive in 1997. Well, we tracked it in. And this is all on my website. If you go to Planet X Photos, It's actually, according to date, earliest to latest, go into the 2001 observatories who saw it. We had three different teams, Vancouver, Flagstaff, Arizona, and France, who saw it. The guy in France was an astronomer who saw it right where the Theta said it would be out in the night sky. And then the next year, because you could only see in that direction in the night sky in the winter, we were doing infrared, and we got an infrared from France, another one from Florida, and a third was attempted in South Africa, but the woman who had reserved the right to use the observatory there in South Africa was, after she drove all the way there from Zaire, was told she couldn't use the observatory, was denied, and subsequently got used a different observatory, and she said she did locate it in infrared. She was a chemist and went with a friend at the Ra and Deck that the Zeta said. Now we go into 2002 to 2003. That winter, we did CCD imaging from an amateur scope in Arizona. A group of people pooled their money together and did this about every weekend. The FITS files are still there for anyone who wants to pull them down and examine, and they cannot be doctored. It was a sort of like a dim star that was traveling along where the Zeta said it should be. And like one week we'd take it, and the next week we'd take it, it had moved it according to where the Zeta said it would move, go back to where it was last week, it's gone. And you compare it to the star charts, it's not supposed to be there, right? In the spring of 2003, on March 26, 2003, I saw it with my own eyes. I was returning from a business trip. And there around 8:30 at night it was, you know, kind of a red blur, you know, in the sky, not a star, I was just stunned. Well, we had, of course, been tracking it worldwide, and dozens of people reported that they were seeing this in the night sky, right at the Ra and Deck, where 7 years earlier the Zeta said it would come. Then it crossed the Earth's orbit and moved closer to the sun, and it got lost in the glare of the sun, but it's showing up all over the place on Soho in photos, and you can see that something is disturbing the Earth's magnetosphere, and it's not the action of the sun because it does not coincide at all with action of the sun, which is very quiet. Sun is very sleepy. So it came in 2003. It just didn't pass. And the Zetas, when challenged, said they knew it wouldn't pass, and they had, it was, they called it the white lie, because they wanted to get George Bush to go into Iraq and his crew and fall on their sword and fail. The Bush family and their cronies were trying to get into Iraq, into Afghanistan, to be able to commandeer all the oil fields, the major oil fields of the world, knowing that the pole shift was coming, and they thought it might come in 2003 when the Zeta said, so that they could be on black gold when the pole shift happens and be the masters of the world. Well, you know, if you'll recall, that they weren't done with weapons of mass destruction in March and April of 2003. But Bush went in anyway in April, early April. He went in ahead of that, and the UN kept saying, we're not done with our inspections, wait. And the U.S. military even had an Operation Planet X on May 15th. They were aware of the Zeta's prediction. And I can tell you, I had people come into town here and hang around my house, too, that were definitely not local yokels, you know, the dark glasses kind of people. One of them was unabashedly military. Anyway, officer, so they didn't know if it would or wouldn't, because it was zooming in at that time, you know, late March, early April. So Bush made his move too early. And it didn't succeed. He didn't succeed in getting the coalition, et cetera, together. Everyone saw it as an oil grab, and they are not in charge of the oil fields, you know, to. So it was the long sorts trying to have become too powerful, and that's why they did it. However, it's next to the sun, and we're going to have the passage, and it's going to be according to the way that they just have described. Hi, Sheldon.
Yeah, what are your thoughts then about this 2012 date? Do you think that's being used as a major distraction so folks won't be prepared on time?
It's not that they won't be prepared. It's that they won't hassle the establishment. Yes, 2012 was the approved date, and there was a flurry of books that came out on a flurry of movies, and the people with the accuracy track record like Zeta Talk, which I just welcome anyone to go into the website and click on Zeta Talk Accuracy. I have a couple little videos, YouTubes, that I link to, too, that describe 16 undeniable instances where the Zetas knew something even before human scientists knew it, before there was any evidence of what they were talking about. There's no way, you know, that I went off and read a book somewhere and made a prediction and then I pointed to a known human fact. That's not what's going on here. So they're very highly accurate, and because of that, they don't really get in the media a lot. You know, you and I here are a side media. We're not CNN, right? We're not Fox News. And the reason for that is it's too accurate, and people start poking around and asking questions and realize the truth. There's no relationship between the Mayan and the Gregorian calendar the way they've lined it up. There was an attempt, several attempts, to line them up. If you actually study this, it's still not a settled issue. The loudest mouth was Thompson, who was a geologist, who was like a forceful personality, who insisted that his choice of December 21st or whatever be the choice. And he just sort of shouted everybody down. But there were many different options, and still are today. If you actually look what he based this on, you know, they have the long calendar, which has no hooks whatsoever. It's like a ruler that's slipping and sliding and can't be stopped or connected to anything along its way. Nothing. No hooks. You have this ceremonial calendar every 260 days, and that just loops and loops and loops. But you can't say that that goes way back to the last time we had a pole shift, 3,600 years ago, the Jewish Exodus. And the reason you can't is because you don't know if people started or stopped. And according to the Zetas, my contacts, they say, well, you know, after a pole shift, people get discombobulated. They lose track. And then later they say, remember when we used to have those ceremonies, and pick it up again? So you don't know if it was continuous. So then there's, well, the modern-day Mayans are practicing according, you know, so you could loop back. But you don't know if there was a disruption, you know, and that they picked it up again. There's no proof of that. Then they had an astronomical calendar, which you do have hooks. You can say, oh, eclipses and planetary lineups, and but that's not connected at all to the long calendar. So here we have this slippery long calendar that has no hooks, and they're trying to line it up to the Gregorian. And what they and there's various you know, like month, day kind of indicators, and so they had a beam, a wooden beam that had a couple of stamps, one from the long calendar and one from the ceremonial, and they did carbon dating on it, which had an error of 3 to 5 year variance. And they said, oh, precisely December 21st. Well, what happened to the 3 to 5 year variance, right? And this is what they're using. It's absolutely an educated guess. It's a dart thrown at the wall. There's no evidence whatsoever that that is the date that the Mayans claimed at all. Certainly, somewhere around this time, they said there would be a big change, right? And so did the Hopi with their red sky. And, you know, we're pretty sure that the Jewish Exodus was the last pole shift, but we can't pin the date down. People are saying that big volcano went off in the Mediterranean, island of Santorini, 628 B.C., more or less. They're not real sure, right? And there's no record keeping. The Egyptian record keeping went to heck during that time. The census stopped being taken. Everything was tossed out on the streets. So there's no precise way to say when the last one was, and there's no precise way to say when the next one will be, but clearly it's going to be soon, because Nibiru, Planet X, Wormwood, the Great Destroyer, the Red Star, it's with us now. You know, lurking there near the sun, creeping past it, and going to come outbound one of these days.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. I've heard Professor McCanny say that the Mayans never said that the world would end on that 2012 date, and I had a friend down in Tennessee. He's part of exposing this moon landing cover-up scam. He told me that the Mayan calendar ends December of next year, 2011,
Yeah, there were people who said it was 2003, and there's been a lot of different dates thrown around, and believe me, there's argument if you do a little research. But what the public is told is, oh no, it's this, you know, and they're told that so that it was far enough away, two years ago or so, it was the approved date, and all these people came out with these books and movies and everything, and oh, wonderful, wonderful, a lot of TV coverage, you know, a lot of, you know, interview for the new book, you know, coast to coast or whatever. And it was because it was far enough out that people weren't going to just stop paying their mortgage or quit their job or whatever just because, you know, somebody was issuing a warning, they would hesitate. You know, but if they thought it was going to be in a couple of months, they might start to make moves. But it was far enough out. Now they're starting to murmur and push that date out a little further and say, well, maybe 2013, the sun is going to go crazy. You know, they're starting to push. NASA is always trying to blame the sun. It's going to be terrible, the worst solar maximum we've ever had. Boy, back in 1894, we had a blackout in Canada, and it was due to a solar CME. And here they, ever since the turn of the century, 2000, year 2000 or so, they've been saying, it's going to be terrible, the worst. And it's been asleep. We had that whole stretch with hardly any sunspots, 260 days with no sunspots. The CMEs are little teensy things. They're not those biggies. And it's like the solar wind is very quiet, very quiescent, and it just continues to be virtually asleep. Finally, the Washington Post had an article about that a couple of days ago. How come the sun is asleep? And it's not what NASA's been harping all the time. They're still saying, it's going to be awful, and you know, the electronics will crash and all. And there's no evidence that the solar maximum they're predicting is going to happen. It's quite the opposite. Well, they want you to believe that any kind of electronic interference is due to the sun and not Planet X. But, you know, I can rattle off a whole bunch of things that have been ascribed, you know, by myself and the Zetas to electronic interference from Planet X, like Air France 44.
Well, I was going to interject by stating, I got a feeling that if the sun is ready to cause some major havoc here, they'll just blame it on a terrorist carrying out one of those EMP attacks on us.
Well, it won't come from the sun. The reason the sun is so sleepy is that Planet X is somewhat between us and the sun, and it's pointing its north pole toward the sun. It's a big magnet. It came in from the direction of Orion and passed by the south pole of the sun. And when it did so, it was nosing its north pole into the sun's south pole, right? Because that's how magnets like to line up. And then as it's leaving and coming outbound now, it has to sling its north pole away and point away, and it's getting ready to line up with the magnetic flow lines above the ecliptic, getting very close to the ecliptic. So it's pointing the north pole in our direction, which is why we have increasing fireballs, which are way beyond what historical record is. These screaming balls of light across, you know, northern Canada, across Scandinavia, into New Zealand, across the Midwest, you know, just a huge record number of them. There's people who keep track, and the average is supposed to be, I think, like 1/100th of what we're getting. You know, that's how much they've increased. And also occasional red dust, and also electromagnetic interference, like with our own Earth's magnetosphere.
So just to clarify, Nancy, you're saying that Planet X is outbound and going out to deep space. It ain't going past Earth anymore, right?
Yes, it is. It's going to go over our head. And you say, well, you know, it's coming at us. It's still closer to the sun than Venus, inside Venus's orbit, and it is outbound. And the passage over our head will occur at some point. The Zetas are not saying. They've given us specifics as to what to look for as far as the last weeks, and that it will happen at the end of an April, an August, or a December, but they won't say which, and they won't say which year. But they've told us a whole ton of stuff of what to expect before the passage happens. And you know, so it's not going to be like this summer. I don't think it's going to be this year either, from what I read.
Well, you see this email I got from Richard Hoagland the other day. You know who he is, right?
Oh, sure.
You know, it's been well over a year since he sent me an email, and I always send him a lot of emails. And for him to even reply to the one that I sent him, he stated, folks, that there is no Planet X. It's a hoax of which you are perpetuating, Sheldon, he stated. You know, that must carry a lot of weight for him to even reply to my email.
Yes.
You know, if there's nothing to it, why would he reply?
Well, here's something very interesting. I don't know if you heard of Dick Morrison, I believe his name is, a NASA
Yes, I've seen that video.
Put out a video, and somebody pointed out to me that I was obviously considered a threat to NASA with what I'm saying, because they put me high on the list, so I watched the first 5 minutes, and the first person he brings up to discredit, and there's my face, you know, on the video, you know, and while he's nattering on about Nancy Leader, and everything he said about me was wrong. I mean, really. He said, now she's saying it's going to be December 21st, 2012, and we don't say that at all. We say the opposite, you know, that it doesn't line up, and you can't, that's not the date. But anyway, you know, he was misinformed completely, probably never actually checked my website, but I was the first person that he put up as a bugaboo who you should not be listening to.
Hey,
yeah.
Nancy, just for the record here, didn't NASA fund Robert Harrington's search for the 10th planet?
Sure. And actually, Harrington was Navy. He was Naval Observatory. Now, you know, for those who don't know, the Navy was front and center with the formation of Majestic 12 when Roswell happened, and Truman and the Army Intel, et cetera, got in touch with aliens and first started chatting with them. It was the Navy, the intelligence arm, that was right in the middle of that. They control observatories. They control the master clocks around the world. And they carry a lot more weight than people would think as to what is released and stated and the like. So he worked for the Naval Observatory, Harrington did. And after they discovered it, on December 18th, 1983, this article appeared in the Washington Post front page saying, blah, blah, we sighted something. We were searching for Nemesis is what they called it, as well as Planet X, I guess. And now we found it, and maybe as close to be as a planet within our solar system, and they're carrying on like that. And then right after that, they said, oh, never mind, it was a complete mistake. It was a mistake. We didn't find anything at all. No, no. And they went out there looking because of perturbations in the outer planets. They were pulling in the direction of Orion, and our long-period comets pull in that direction.
Right. Planet X was actually named because they were looking. Pluto was named because they were looking for Planet X.
But Pluto was too small. Right. So Harrington said, oh, I'm going to go down to New Zealand with my telescope where I can get a better view of this inbound planet. And the people need to know, Van Flandern, I think, said it should be probably about five times as big as the Earth. Well, the Zetas say four times the diameter, 23 times the mass. But Harrington and Van Flandern were saying, oh, yeah, there it is. And so they couldn't trust him to keep his mouth shut because a certain element decided that panic in the public was something they didn't want to deal with.
Okay, folks, well, we're going to be coming into the break here now, the bottom of the hour break. We'll continue this when we come out of the break. This will possibly go into the beginning of the second hour, but that's fine. You're listening to The Light of Day on the Orion Talk Radio Network. We're live Saturday night, June 26, 2010. We're live except for this pre-recorded interview that I'm playing from this morning. This is a pre-recorded interview with Nancy Leader out of North Freedom, Wisconsin. She's been in the Planet X topic for a very, very long time, and I don't necessarily agree with all her viewpoints, and neither does my friend John DiNardo, but at the same token, she's a very sharp researcher when it comes to elaborating upon specificity.
Free speech guaranteed.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the Light of Day with your host, Sheldon Day, coming to you live Saturday night, June 26, 2010. You're listening to the Orion Talk Radio Network. We're going to resume playback now of the pre-recorded interview from this morning with Planet X, one of the forefront Planet X researchers out there, Nancy Leader. So we'll get right back into it. Here it is.
They killed Harrington.
Interestingly enough, Van Flandren died early last year, and he died of a cancer as well.
Cancer can be imparted, and they can inject you with aggressive cancers, yes. And there's more than one assassination. It's a grueling death, you know. They can inject you with something horrid, you know, and fast-acting. And, he was killed.
Now, what are your thoughts about Planet X being involved in this oil volcano going off in the Gulf? Do you think it did anything there?
Yeah, but indirectly. And here's what's going on with Planet X's influence on the Earth. We have an Earth wobble that's actually detectable since early 2004, after it came close enough to the Earth and its influence was enough. It pushes against our North Pole when the North Pole comes round. It grabs at our South Pole. It jerks us around. This is so evident in around 2003, 2004. I was measuring twice a day what I would call shuddering of the world on the live seismographs, and I have dozens of examples of this on my website, where 12 hours apart, every seismograph in the world goes, you know, at the same time. Every seismograph in the world does that. 12 hours later, and the thing is, it's at exactly 0 and 12 UTC, thereabouts. When the Atlantic Rift is facing the sun and the inbound Planet X, or it's in opposition on the other side of the globe, right in the dark side. Well, that's one. And then the Earth wobble started, and I had teams of people measure all over the world. Where does your sun rise? Where does it set? You know, that type of, how high is the arc? And compare it to what should be recorded, you know, for their location and time. And when you're above the North Pole and look down, it forms like a figure eight. And this has been consistent. I think I did it about last fall, every 6 months or so, but for a while there I was doing it quite a bit, almost monthly. And it was always this figure eight, you know. And so therefore people will say, oh, man, the sun is way too north. It's rising or setting way too north or way too south, whatever, you know. And it depends on what part of the globe you're in, you know, because the wobble does twist things around. But this wobble is what's causing our erratic weather, because we are pushed under the air, and so therefore the winds suddenly come up. You know, we'll have vertical jet streams instead of kind of horizontal across the continental United States. There's so much evidence of it, right? And you know, I've been running my mouth off and I forgot your question. Oh, you said the Gulf, right. Now, what happens to the globe when it's pushed back and forth like that? For one thing, continental drift is accelerated. The pulling apart of the Atlantic, the compression of the Pacific, right? And, you know, like that big 9.5 we had in Sumatra in late 2004. But North America can't adjust. A lot of continents can move. Africa is rolling. Its Rift Valley is ripping apart. Huge crevasses. The Red Sea is pulling apart. We have the edge of the Indo-Australia plate near, you know, east of Australia rising. The tsunami boys in the Coral Sea are going clean. And they're saying there's less depth now to the ocean because that whole plate is rising.
Hey, Nancy.
Huh?
I just wanted to ask you really quick, if you know that the seabed floor out in the coral reef is rising 13 feet a day. Where is all that water going to?
Well, obviously, you know, water will move in all directions, and all the oceans touch each other, and so, you know, it's just deflecting into the vast Pacific and vast Indian Ocean and around to the Atlantic, et cetera. So it's got a lot of ways to go. It's not like, you know, if you have a little bit of water, it's like a bump in the ocean. You know, it moves and it disperses.
Right, I understand, but how come we're not seeing the coastlines of Australia being flooded right now from that?
Actually, the east coast of Australia is rising. And that's why the Tsunami Boy is finding that it has less depth down to the seabed floor.
Oh, wow.
But what is losing sea level elevation is Bangladesh. They are losing islands, for instance. That plate, which includes India and Australia, is diving under the Himalayas, is being lifted and pushed. And this kind of thing will continue. So getting back to the Gulf, we have almost every continent can kind of roll or pull apart or something, but it can give, but except for North America. North America has a flat top. If you go from Japan all the way over to Iceland, you see a line. You know, if you were floating up there above the North Pole, you would see this line. It's almost straight. And it has a flat top, and it can't roll because of that. So it doesn't move, but the Atlantic pulls apart down where Mexico is, pushing Mexico to the west. Now what's happening is that the North American continent is being pulled into a bowl. The Aleutian Islands is being pulled toward the tip of Mexico, that type of thing, and the bowl is cracking at San Diego where they have all those water main splits. And this is stress that will not be relieved until the New Madrid fault line, and I mean all the way from the Great Lakes down into Mexico, huge adjustments, right? And slides so that to the west of the Mississippi, everything moves a little bit to the southwest and drops. The land drops a little bit to the west of the Mississippi. So a lot of flooding there. And when that happens, the stress will be relieved. But in the meantime, there's terrible pressure. We have sinkholes happening, you know. But what we also have is a lot of pressure on the oil pools in the Gulf of Mexico, which are part of the North American continent. So here we have this oil pool under pressure, and here comes BP like a wasp with a stinger and pops that oil bubble, and oh dear.
Now, you told me you watched John Moore's DVD, right?
Yeah, I did.
He said that either the Navy or Gordon Michael Skelling says the whole state of Wisconsin is going to be toast. What do you think of that?
I know, and I'm very curious about this, and also, in case you noticed the movie 2012, they reference Wisconsin a couple times. One is when California is falling apart, and there's these big crevasses, and this very chunky woman comes out and says, "Herbert, I told you we should be going back to Wisconsin."
Yeah, I remember that part.
Yeah, and then in the end, they said, "Oh, the new South Pole is Wisconsin," and it turns out everybody knew somebody that lived in Wisconsin, right? So it's like, oh, well, they damn Wisconsin. At first it looks like a safe place to go because California's in trouble, but later, oops, too bad. Well, actually, I was just fascinated by that because that's the only map that I've seen, you know, that had that Navy map that John Moore was showing. And this is what I've concluded. They don't want people to come to Wisconsin because they have plans for Wisconsin. Do you know that the ELF facility...
Clam Lake?
Well, it's up in northern Wisconsin, and it does something with sending vibrations through the interior of the earth to communicate with submarines that here and there around the world.
Yeah, I recall that. Yep.
And I think it's ELF.
Right.
Frequency, something extra low or low frequency or something like
it's
that.
It's ELF, yep. Uh-huh.
Yep. And they've got that facility in northern Wisconsin. I believe it's the only one of its kind. So if you wanted, you know, to make sure that people didn't migrate to Wisconsin, you'd scare them off. So this, you know, but I'm telling you, this is not going to be a bad place. It's going to have a climate like Alabama. Got good soil and water, rolling hills, small farms, you know. And I don't have any kind of a feeling, you know, that this is a dangerous place. It'll have hits like every other place. Like, for instance, the peninsula, you can see, is splitting away. If you go down the peninsula and hit Green Bay and travel your eye along toward Madison, a lot of little lakes there. And I think that's splitting, and it'll split further. And you can see in Duluth at Lake Superior that it's diving. They have some really deep caverns up there near Duluth. You can go all the way out to the Black Hills in the Dakotas and see that rumpling and understand that the effect of a seaway pulling apart, and the seaway is pulling apart and will radically, that'll affect a lot of land. But I don't think they've said Michigan will be fine and Minnesota and Wisconsin, and of course there'll be some effects, but they're not going to go under the waves. They're not going to disappear.
Yeah, I was actually up there visiting a friend in Milwaukee a few months ago, and we were riding the city bus, and he showed me this big bluff that sits on right along Lake Michigan there, and he says, oh, I don't totally agree with that, John Moore. Look at that big bluff, and look how down, you know, far down below the water level is.
Yeah. It doesn't make logical sense, but he's just reporting what the Navy said, you know. And the Ozarks will do well, too. They will.
You know, and a lot of that information was passed from these Navy people back in the mid-80s, so maybe things have changed since, you know, the Navy people told John that.
I would be very curious what the basis of that is, because he doesn't report the basis. He says, you know, here's what they said to me. Here's their map, and he has no explanation. And I just don't know. But the future maps, like there was one put out by Lori Toy that shows even the Sierras for some reason going underwater all the way up into Utah and Nevada and New Mexico. And it makes no sense because that's an area of mountain building with the subduction happening. So she's got all that crumbling underwater. And then various other maps after that showed something similar, even scallions. But not our map, not our new geography map. So the Zeta spoke to the issue of why there was that difference, and Lori Toy put hers out in 1983, and everybody else followed, and they said it was this suggestion or influence that something should happen to the Sierras, to these other people that were channeling. You know, Dolores Cannon was another one, and she had a very weird map. So a lot of different theories, but the Zetas have been right about so much, you know, about what they've come out with. Most of their predictions haven't had a chance to happen yet, but they predicted that the weather that we're having now, just exactly, back in 1995, described it, and it came about crop shortages. Now everybody's admitting we've got that worldwide. They said worldwide, and why? They explained why there would be crop shortages.
Well, Nancy, that's another thing. You always have this camp out there, and I was part of this camp for, you know, a while, that the weather warfare weapons are causing all this. John Lear, he's been on Coast to Coast. He states there's over 30 orbiting weapons platforms above Earth that could cause these weather warfare type of events. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the guy is being fed a bunch of bull and he's spouting it, you know. But you notice all these people with absolutely unprovable theory, no track record whatsoever of anything they ever say. You know, they get all the prime time. You know, we have the track record, and we don't get on because we're too accurate. But beyond that, beyond the fact that there's no proof, you know, here we have, we're running shuttles up, and if we have a bad O-ring, the shuttle blows up like a firecracker. You know, that's our track record. You know, we're not that well advanced, you know. So all these secret things, making earthquakes, changing the weather, you know, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans on purpose, and man doesn't have that capability. And in the second place, even if he did, why would he be trying to create worldwide crop shortages? You know, well, you go into the whole thing, then they have to come up with a reason for that. Well, they're trying to wipe people out and get rid of, yes, there is a group that wants to get rid of, you know, too much population. That's why AIDS was encouraged to happen. You know, it was some people saying, well, this was one of the alternatives, you know, alternative 1, 2, and 3, to get rid of the world's excess population. But they would do that by other means, you know, like bad vaccination batches. Or bioterrorism, where, whoops, we've got some germ running around in this city. The wealthy, the elite, the ones that they wanted, they get warned, they get taken out of the city, everybody else dies, you know. Or blocking the city in quarantine so they can't get out. Or dirty nukes, you know, right in the inner city where the people that they don't want anymore get wiped out. Those are the approaches that they would use, not destroying their world's ability to grow crops.
Well, me and my friend John DiNardo look at it this way. For the people out there that say, oh, it was Project HAARP that did it, me and John think that, yes, they might use it some of the time, but they're not going to use these weather warfare toys all of the time, because they themselves, the elite, see these cataclysmic earth changes coming, and they just, they're panicking about it, so they don't want it.
That's my point. It's not something that an intelligent person would do. If you wanted to rid your town of, you know, so many people and you had them targeted, you wouldn't just take a flamethrower to the whole town. You know, I mean, then you destroy what you want. So there are people that want to sculpt the population, and they have tried this kind of thing. Under George Bush, we had numerous attempts to create a bird flu pandemic. You know, where they would, and for instance, there was a 1957 live virus release to 4,000 different labs around the world under Bush, out of a U.S. lab. And when this was discovered, it was quickly called back, and they retrieved them all. But the point of that was that some lab worker was supposed to get the 1957 bird flu, which was deadly, and it would spread. And there was numerous attempts to do something similar under Bush, because the Bush-Cheney crowd was part of this New World Order. And then what we would do is, oh, I'm president for life, and now we're sitting on the oil fields, and the Saudi oil fields.
Oh, Nancy. That's another thing we must not forget. The Bush, he purchased a huge swath of land down in the middle of South America and Paraguay.
Paraguay.
Remember
yes.
that?
Yep. And they know what's coming. I mean, why would he go there? You'd think they would be good Americans, right? Go up to Wyoming with Cheney or something.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, I was just... That was my point, you know. It's like begs the question, why Paraguay? Well, Paraguay's going to do well. You know, the new equator is going to run right down the middle of the Pacific from the Bering Straits through Antarctica, back up the Atlantic, you know, through Greenland and Iceland and over. And Alaska will be very tropical. And, you know, Paraguay and Argentina and those countries are going to be very temperate, you know, like... I don't know, Alabama. You know, they're very pleasant to live in. They have good water. They're not overpopulated. And a number of elite are heading in that direction.
I can't remember the episode that Professor Jim McCanny did on that, but he was actually doing some satellite imaging of that swath of land Bush had purchased in Paraguay, and he's seen that there was some, like, underground piping coming up from above the surface there, but then all of a sudden it disappeared off the satellite images, you said?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Wouldn't be surprised. They like to think of underground bunkers. Although, you know, frankly, those are going to be death traps. If you think of magnitude 9 earthquakes happening worldwide, right, and all that rock slamming this way and that way, and they go down, you know, they have ventilation tubes, maybe they have elevators or whatever. And if you get your door bent catawampus so you can't pull it open, or your elevator won't rise or, you know, go down, and you can't breathe, you know, you're going to a very bad death, yeah.
So what would be the best purpose for the underground cave cities? Would it be to escape the solar scorching, or?
No. They really want to go underground because they think the pole shift of history, of legend, you know, and it doesn't wipe everything out, you know, because it's in folklore everywhere, and there's records of it from the Egyptians and the West Coast Indians and, you know, even the Chinese, there's records. It's high winds, a lot of hail, you know, a lot of those fireballs, red dust turning the water bitter, big earthquakes, and all of this, things thudding down, you know, like rocks and the like, high winds. There's even firestorms, very rare, but they do happen. The West Coast Indians reported them, and around the Mediterranean reported them because of the volcanoes that in the tail of Planet X, which, you know, whips and wafts the earth during the passage, are a lot of petrochemicals. This is actually where our oil comes from, per the Zetas. Did you know you cannot recreate oil in a lab? They say, oh, it's the pressure, and it's this, and the dinosaurs, and that. Well, if that was the case, you could create that pressure and put things in there, and voila, you'd make oil. Well, they can't do it. And they can't do it because it, in fact, is these petrochemicals that waft over the heat of a volcano and form oil, and if they don't burn up because there's no spark or whatever, oxygen in the air at the time, it falls to the ground and dribbles into cracks, and that's why you have oil pools. You know, it is. And where does the petrochemicals in the tail come from? The asteroid belt. And this is where Planet X went through in the past. There were water planets there, which were life-bearing planets. This is where our dirty snowballs come from, the comets that come through, water and particles, and where, of course, the asteroids came from. That was all the lava in the planets that blew out into space and hardened. And the petrochemicals, because Planet X has a charge tail, it went through the asteroid belt, collected all this stuff, and it's greasy. There's a greasy element in our atmosphere now from this tail, which is wafting around. Halos around moons and around the sun, people are getting some nausea and headaches and things like that. There's a greasy element in the air, and so there can be firestorms that fall. So go underground. You're also you're protected from the poor common man who's out there running and screaming and being pummeled to death, by hail and burned up and blowing around in the wind, and they're down there laughing and playing golf.
So they're going underground to just hope for the best, but they know they can't escape all the Earth cataclysms.
Well, they can't escape them, but they figure they'll ride them out and they'll come out afterwards. But, the Zetas say that's the last place you would want to go into some hole in the ground like that that's going to collapse on you, It would be better off, in a ravine, in a trench, crouched against a cliff, that kind of thing, than underground, because it can be a tomb.
Wow. I know of a man that lives up in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. He's in touch with a woman. He considers her a rogue element of the Pleiadian star system, and he said, I guess she's told him that this Planet X is actually a rocket ship. What do you think of that?
Well, that's not at all what the Zetas say, and it certainly isn't acting like a rocket ship. It's certainly acting like a planet, that's visible, shrouded by dust. That you can see it when the dust glints off that dust, when the sunlight glints off that dust cloud. Looks like a second sun rising or setting. It's round. And there's no evidence whatsoever, So I don't agree with any of that, nope. And nor do the Zetas.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that either. I've heard Marshall Masters and some others say that this is behaving a lot like a comet.
It has a sling orbit. It is not an orbit that goes around and around. And there is two suns that it, you might say orbit, but it's really slinging past. You know how a pendulum reacts? It comes down in the middle, and then it goes up to one side, comes back, and goes up to another side, comes back and forth. That's what it's doing. And it formed that way, and formed that orbit when everything was coalescing out of the Big Bang. Our sun has actually got a binary. It's out in the direction of Orion, and it's a dark, unlit sun. It's 18.74 sun-Pluto distances out there. And that's, part of the reason that everything is leaning or perturbing in that direction. Not just that Planet X comes from that direction, but that the sun's binary is out there, too. And so it slings past. It comes into our solar system very rapidly. Creeps past the sun, because there is a repulsion force. It doesn't slam into the sun. And if you want me to talk about the repulsion force, I will. And then it slings on out a little further, and it says, whoops, now both my suns are behind me. It turns around and comes back down like a pendulum toward the middle, and momentum keeps it going past the second sun on the other side. So it's a sling orbit. And there are comets that swing through. There's comets that have round orbits, and there's comets that have almost straight-line orbits past. So I can't remember what the names of those various trajectories are. But some can describe it as a comet. But we prefer to say that it's a sling orbit.
So where is the sun's companion right now?
Well, the sun, it's out there in the direction of Orion. But you can't see it.
Okay, folks, we're coming into the break. You're listening to The Light of Day with your host, Ellen Day, on Orion Talk Radio. We'll be back to wrap this up. There's maybe, 15 minutes or so left yet. We'll be back.
The Orion Talk Radio Network is here. The First Amendment of the Constitution grants us freedom of speech. That's the freedom to express our views and opinions without censorship. If you listen to mainstream radio at all, you'll notice that free speech is pretty hard to find these days, with just a handful of networks offering programs that dare to discuss topics and issues that have a profound impact on our daily lives. The mainstream media simply lies by omission and distortion of the facts. The Orion Talk Radio Network is committed to bringing you entertaining and thought-provoking programming that dares to tell the truth. And you can help us as we grow our network. If you think you have what it takes to host a show, you know of someone interested in hosting a show, or any other suggestions, comments, or questions, please drop us an email at OrionTalkRadio@gmail.com. That's OrionTalkRadio@gmail.com. And thank you for listening to the Orion Talk Radio Network. We have more listeners than the big boys' HD2 channels. This is Micro 1650.